Manchmal willst du einfach nur ans Meer. Oder durch die Straßen einer lebendigen Stadt schlendern. Oder endlich den Moment genießen. Einfach die Welt mit TUI neu erleben. Mit TUI reist du so, wie du willst. Als Familie, zu zweit oder einfach allein. Flexibel, sicher und immer mit dem guten Gefühl, dass jemand da ist, wenn es drauf ankommt. Gestalte mit TUI Urlaub ganz nach deinen Wünschen. Überall im Reisebüro, auf tui.com und in der App.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Hi everyone, I hope you're well. I have got a bit of a flurry of episodes happening at the moment, and today, as a special episode for the first ever Truth and Reconciliation Day, I'm grateful to be able to chat with Danielle Paradis, an Indigenous journalist from Edmonton, Alberta. Now, Danny describes herself as a Métis prairie girl, we'll chat about that, and she's researched and helped me write several Canadian true crime episodes, including the Mayerthorpe tragedy and Saskatoon freezing deaths, and we have more with her in the works. We have tried several times to have a chat after an episode, but this is the first time we've been able to synchronize our schedules. As well as Truth and Reconciliation Day, we'll also be chatting about the Miranda Peter episode, a bit of a discussion about the concept of justice and storytelling. Danny will be telling us what she's been writing about and what she's doing and more. See the show notes for approximate timestamps and all the links to the things that we talk about. So without further ado, hello to Danielle Paradis.
Hi, Christy.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, great, great. Now, Danny, as we were talking about earlier, you are a prolific writer and creator, and you have a special interest in Indigenous and women's issues. You've written pieces for Chatelaine, Canada Land, and more. And I want to know, what's your background? How on earth are you so productive, and how can I steal some of your energy?
It's so funny to hear somebody else say that. I think that I feel the same way about a lot of other people. So if that makes you feel better, I'm just pretending to have it all together, and I don't have it any more together than anyone else. As to my secret, I think just sort of like a constant feeling of guilt that I carry around, that I'm like not doing enough. That really seems to provide me with a lot of energy. So yeah, that and of course coffee, the tool of any writer, and the odd yoga class, just to really try and get away from thinking about crime.
How did you get into journalism, and why am I seeing you everywhere right now?
You know, it kind of comes in fits and starts in journalism, and then there comes a certain point, I guess, when you become like emerging, maybe, I would call it. And I think right at this point, that's where I am. So that's why you're seeing me everywhere, because I'm like refusing. I'm just saying yes to everything and then like frantically trying to figure out how I'm supposed to fit it into my days. Writing, I've been... Yeah, I know.
I'm one of those people. Danny, do this.
And I love it.
And you're like, yes.
And I just say yes. So I have no one to blame but myself.
See, I'm the opposite. I say no to everything.
Well, you know, that's good. That's like really good time management. So congratulations to you.
Well, thanks.
Good boundary setting.
Yes, as I hang out in the basement all by myself.
That's right. Background-wise, I've been writing for over 10 years now. I started in blogging early on, and I really started writing through fighting with men's rights activists online, actually.
Oh, right. Nice.
So, yeah, it was...
I didn't expect that.
I know. I was in school for writing, and I was blogging and tweeting, but I became involved in activism. Like, I led the local slut walks here when I was I'm 34 now. I was about 20 1, 22 when I was planning these things. And wow. One day I stumbled across this little video about like feminism being evil. And so in my naivety, I was like, oh, like, I'm going to explain feminism to this guy. And like, he just doesn't really understand what it's all about. So I like innocently made this little video and it was insane. Like, you know, the amount of like attention it got, I was not ready for. And then I kind of like, so then they wanted to do all these, like, they're always like, you know, debate me, coward. It's the online thing. And I kind of gave up on that because I realized like, oh, like these particular people I'm fighting with, like, have a lot of time on their hands and I don't. So that kind of gave me like a first launch into writing. And then I've written for Bustle in the States, the Good Men Project. I wrote a lot about feminism and gender and sexual violence. And that was partly informed by my activism, partly informed by like my own personal experiences with sexual violence and sort of coming to terms with that, which I think I really healed through activism. And so that was always a passion of mine. And then being Métis, so that was a process of discovery, I would say. In my early writing, it doesn't really show up. I knew that we had some Indigenous background, but that was something that the family didn't really talk about. And then my sister became very interested and I became very interested, and she's better at paperwork than I am. So she's a formal member of the Métis Nation, and I have to finish signing all my forms and send them off Manitoba. But, you know, we were in a process of reconnecting to our backgrounds. And that was, I mean, that's been kind of going on throughout large pieces of our life. So as the older sister, you know, she's taking on like the family historian roles, telling me stories about our backgrounds. And then in that time, I came to understand that in particular, Indigenous women are, you know, the targets of violence, often like within the community and like externally. So in the whole broader Canadian world. And that became, I suppose I was in foster care when I was younger, and I've always been sensitized to, you know, certain stories. And one of them would be stories about women, and another would be stories about violence and injustice. And I think it comes from those early life experiences.
Wow.
Yeah. Thank you for asking.
That was really, really great. Now, since my audience is not all from Canada, mm-hmm. would you mind telling us a little bit about what Métis is and what you've kind of discovered about your heritage and stuff?
Sure. So Indigeneity is often a really complex topic. So for people, like, let's say if you have listeners from the U.S., a really familiar concept in the States would be called blood quantum, which would be about like what percentage of Indigenous are you, or how much Indigenous blood do you have? In Canada, that has sort of been imported as a question that people ask, but it's not really how a nation would identify whether or not you are Indigenous. So for Métis, I will say, like, my family is from Red River. We belong to the Manitoba Métis Federation. And so that's a specific collective of Indigenous people. And I'm being very careful to set that up, because the Manitoba Métis have certain conceptions about who counts as Métis and who doesn't. And that can be quite controversial. And I guess I'm not really, I don't tend to speak a lot on whether or not I think somebody should be Métis. Right now, we just got a notice that like the nation is withdrawing from the Métis National Council due to fights over who gets to be considered Métis. So that's really fascinating. So like right in the middle of this where that's going on. And I think, let's say, the foundations of Métis, as I understand it, as a Red River Métis, would be the marriage of settlers, often Scottish, Irish, and French, in the prairie provinces. So often with Cree, or in some cases, Anishinaabe people, who came together and then formed a specific distinct culture from either one of the communities that they had existed in before. So you will hear some people say that Métis is mixed, but it's more than that. Like, say if you are a white settler in Quebec and you marry an Anishinaabe person and you have children. Your children aren't Métis. Métis belongs to a specific cultural subset, and that's within predominantly the prairies, although there are some other groups who call themselves Eastern Métis in Ontario.
It's all really interesting, and I'm thankful that you've taken the time to explain it to us, Danny. So before we start today, I wanted to acknowledge that at the time of recording, tomorrow is September the 30th, 2021, and it's the first National Day for Truth and Reconciliation here in Canada. And the day has been acknowledged previously as Orange Shirt Day, and it honours the lost children and survivors of residential schools, their families, and their communities. It's a public commemoration. It's been designated as a national public holiday, although it's up to the individual provinces to decide whether it is a holiday in the provinces. And sadly, I live in one of the provinces that said it's not. And I believe you do too, Danny. I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing Alberta said no.
Yes. Yes, they did.
Yeah, it's like Ontario and Alberta, the tragic, like, provinces, although I have to say Alberta's probably a little bit worse right now.
We're pretty tragic, yes.
Oh man, if you don't laugh, you'll cry, right?
Exactly. Yes, very much so.
Danny, one of the things that I've noticed about this is that there's been a lot of like commercialization around the whole wear an orange t-shirt thing. And with my kids being in school, every year we're asked to buy an orange t-shirt, and we've never been told ever like where we should buy this t-shirt from. And this year I found out that there is an actual Orange Shirt Day organization that donates the profits back to Indigenous aid organizations. But their cutoff was like before the schools were notified to wear an orange shirt. So I feel like by the time parents were out there buying their shirts, we couldn't buy it from official channels that gave the money back to Indigenous organizations. And in the mm-hmm. meantime, there's all kinds of rogue operators out there trying to make money off the selling of these shirts to commemorate a day of Indigenous tragedy, but yet they're keeping the profits for themselves. And it really annoys me. Like, I also hate Valentine's Day too. So, like, you know, it's like the commercialization of a right. emotion, and like people profiting off this that they shouldn't be. So next year I've put a notification on my calendar for early September to say, buy your frickin' Orange Shirt Day t-shirt now so that you know, buy it from the correct place and not have to buy it from Old Navy or something. But that's my preamble. Danny, I wanted to know, like, as a Métis person, what does the day mean to you beyond mm-hmm. that or even including that?
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be some grifters out there. I don't know what yeah. we do about that, but I really appreciate, you know, your efforts to actually to look and make sure that Indigenous organizations are being supported. I would say in previous years, perhaps that infrastructure wasn't set up either.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't beat yourself up about it. But I think what the 30th means to me, I mean, for one, I've been writing about some Indigenous, well, they themselves are not survivors, but their mother was a survivor of a residential school. And so for a piece that will come out later in a local magazine, I interviewed two sisters and spoke to them about their mother and her experience in residential schools. And she had passed away, but Beverly and Linda, the sisters, were very haunted by the experiences that their mother had, and then even attempts to heal or, you know, make sure that there was recognition for what had happened to her were traumatizing to her, because she, I mean, as the sisters told me in an interview, like, she spent her whole life trying to forget things. So certain stories that came out, like stories of a police van that they called the Black Maria, that would take the children away from their communities and that would go and look for children when they'd run away. You know, it gave me shivers, yeah, to hear those things. And then, you know, the mother lived with that as her early childhood experience her whole life and spent most of her time trying to forget that it had happened. So I've been thinking about their story and more broadly, they're a part of what's called the Michelle Band in Alberta. And for the listeners who haven't heard of Michelle Band, they were involuntarily enfranchised according to their website and their members. And what that means is that they lost their status under the Indian Act in Canada. So except for a few members who couldn't be enfranchised because they were in one case locked up in a mental institution. So these members are trying to reckon with a legacy of being removed as, you know, Indigenous. Like one of the sisters told me, like, oh, they got rid of the band but forgot to get rid of the Indians, in her words. And so, you know, even in the midst of this understanding of residential schools, there's other things that have been done to Indigenous communities to erase them and to Indigenous women. Like a non-Indigenous man and you were an Indigenous woman, you'd lose your status. And there was actually court cases that had that, that fought that out and helped to reestablish and I don't know what the term would be. It wouldn't be enfranchised, but like it would give them back their Indigenous status under the Indian Act. Yeah. And that would be, I mean, you know, simultaneously we're dealing with like a very paternalistic piece of legislation, but also the only thing that gives you your cultural identifiers and the hunting and fishing and gathering rights that a lot of communities still survive on. So wow. So I've just been thinking, yeah, it's there's not just one story. You know, there's not just the children being taken away and dying in residential schools. There's also the children like Bev and Linda's mother who survived and lived outside of her community for her whole life, like just never went home, and their family lost their culture that way.
Ugh. After the break, Danny and I talk about Cindy Gladue, Miranda Shelley Peter, what's going on in her neck of the woods in Edmonton, and more.
Manchmal willst du einfach nur ans Meer oder durch die Straßen einer lebendigen Stadt schlendern oder endlich den Moment genießen. Einfach die Welt mit TUI neu erleben. Mit TUI reist du so, wie du willst. Als Familie, zu zweit oder einfach allein. Flexibel, sicher und immer mit dem guten Gefühl, dass jemand da ist, wenn es drauf ankommt. Gestalte mit TUI Urlaub ganz nach deinen Wünschen. Überall im Reisebüro, auf tui.com und in der App.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
So, Danny, I know that you've worked on quite a few Indigenous stories now, with the story of Bev and Linda and their mother most recently. What others have you worked on?
Yeah, like the one that I just mentioned is kind of the main one, but there's also Cindy Gladue, which will be an episode for you one day. The family is, I think, very exhausted from trial after trial, and so... Yeah. They haven't yet been willing to talk. I do hope that they do, but even if they don't, I think, you know, Cindy's story is very important. I wrote for that one for Chatelaine, and that's about an Indigenous mother who died in a motel room at the hands of a truck driver who essentially left her to bleed to death in a bathtub. That's not the kind of story that you can hear and just forget. Yeah. So. You know, I've been thinking a lot about Cindy and her family and the multiple court cases that they had to go through to get some modicum of justice. And I mean, I haven't heard directly from the family, but the victim impact statements, you know, how do you get justice after having to go through so many court cases and hear so many things and even see, like, there's the media and the defendant both used a picture of Cindy smoking, as for example, and it's just a picture right. of her looking at the camera and smoking. And there are lots of pictures of Cindy out there, but this seems to be one of the most common ones. And so I spoke to a lawyer who represented Cindy's family during these court cases, like more for emotional support, and because as your listeners will be aware, the Crown isn't there to defend the families, they're there to defend the state.
Yep.
So this lawyer was here, Lisa Weber, was advocating for the family. And that picture is a really, like, it's such a difficult one for them, because that picture was introduced primarily to show the court that, oh, she was smoking, and that's like smoking and drinking is in fact
yeah, what she was bad.
Led to her death. Well, and that they tried to use it for like a medical rationale as to why she died, why she bled to death.
Oh.
So it was, yeah, I mean, of course, it's also showing, oh, here's this smoking Indigenous woman and she drank, and there's some victim blaming aspects in there, but they kind of extended that into like the medical world. And so it's just really horrifying to see, you know, a picture that's like a picture of you or a picture of a family member used against the victim.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, those are just two stories that have been on my mind. There's a few others that are just sort of, I'm just sort of starting to research them. So I'm not sure I'm ready to write about them yet or to talk about them yet.
Right. So what will you be doing to commemorate the day or to kind of acknowledge the day? I know you were saying that you're working on a whole bunch of content and I'm looking forward to sharing it.
Thank you. Yes. I also, in addition to writing, I work for what's called Indigenous Friends Association. And that organization's produced some, just statements on Every Child Matters, on Orange Shirt Day. So I'll of course have that. And also I'm a journalism professor. Actually, sorry, let me rephrase that. I'm not a professor, but my kids keep calling me a professor. So
I was just about to faint. I'm like, what? What? You can't.
I'm an instructor.
No, please, get some sleep.
Okay, let me say that again. I teach journalism at McEwen University this year, two courses. And so one of them does fall on the 30th. And so I was just earlier today considering the ways in which I can mark the event. And I think the best way to do that is through story. You know, Indigenous yeah. people are amazing storytellers, and journalism is the discipline of stories. So I'm going to show them a video that actually talks about, like, that shares some survivors' experiences in the residential system or how it affected their families. So that and a little bit of reflection is kind of what I'm introducing into this for the students to think about. Think about residential schools, think about Canada as a country, and kind of a small way to start them down the path of looking and understanding Indigenous stories more deeply than it has been before.
So let's talk about Miranda Shelley Peter. This case was actually proposed to me very early on in the podcast, and a person just kind of submitted it as the case of James Joe Ward, the Yukon teenager who murdered his girlfriend and kept her body under his bed. And my researcher, Haley Gray, picked the case out from a short list, but I didn't realize until after I'd received the research that it was the very embodiment of a missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit case. And from then I was like, okay, so I can't just tell a story. I have to explain some concepts and some history. And I went through the records, the news archives from Whitehorse during the time to see exactly how the print media covered her disappearance. And it was crazy to see how little her case was focused on. And Miranda was always at the end. And, you know, even when her picture was shown, like, it was like an afterthought. And it just made me so sad how the first announcement of her disappearance didn't show in the paper until she'd been gone for 3 weeks. And despite her mother reporting it in the first 2 days, and it just made me so sad. Like, it was just such a stark like example of the plight of these poor people and what they have to deal with when they report crimes. And I feel like the case has kind of been, it's another one of those stories that's been swept under the rug, you know? What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complex story, but you're absolutely right. Like, Miranda was just so much of an afterthought in the media, and I guess partly because this happened prior to the rise of murdered and missing Indigenous women, like as a known cultural phenomena, and yeah. as the demands for the inquiry grew. But it's just really striking the way that she was erased, or even in the, like, I'm not going to be telling too many spoilers, right? Are we assuming they've listened to the episode?
No, already? Yeah, we're assuming okay. They've listened to the episode.
Okay. So, you know, just how little was done to find her, and how one organization, in this case, the RCMP, got to tell the whole narrative. Like, it was really striking.
Yes.
How you talked about multiple, like, they were talking about, oh, we're doing this, like, cross-country search. But she's under her boyfriend's bed. Like, that's where her
just
body
down the
is.
Road.
Yeah. That just makes my skin crawl. Like, how little concern. Like, nobody looked under his bed.
Right. I just keep imagining the RCMP going and speaking to Miranda's mother, Jessie. Jessie saying, okay, well, I saw her with James. And then the RCMP go to James's house. And obviously he's taken off on his 10-day bender trip, and his father is there. And what did his father say to the RCMP? Yeah, he's gone. Yeah, he's fine. He didn't do it. And then they just left. I don't, like, did they ask to have a look in his room? Like, I don't understand why. Like, if a 15-year-old is missing and her boyfriend has run off, like, doesn't that tell you that there's something a little bit more to be looked into?
Yeah, I mean, you think you would at least, like, ask to look in his, like, in his room, or even, you know, I mean, attempt to get a warrant, obviously, but, like, it just, the bare minimum was not done. And then even, I mean, how much more horrifying that became for the family, like, knowing how close their loved one was, and yet how little was done to find her.
Yeah, because months after she disappeared, they were still saying, like, the cause of her disappearance is unknown and we don't think there's any foul play involved. Like, how could they have come to that conclusion?
Yeah, and I mean, especially as, like, experienced police officers, like, this isn't an unfamiliar story, unfortunately, like domestic violence, domestic incidents. Yeah. You know, that's something that they deal with a lot, but it seems like they kind of, although I don't think this was explicitly said, it reminded me of those, like, runaway stories, right? Like, oh, yeah. Well, she must have just decided she wanted to leave and just run away. Like, that's what it seemed like to me, even though I don't think that they made that statement.
No, they didn't make that statement. It was always just, she has a history of running away, but she's never been gone for longer than a week. So, like, I don't know why after a week they're still thinking that she might still be a runaway, but clearly that's what they thought.
Yeah.
I also wanted to know what you thought about Justin Jim, the teenager who was kind of swirled up in the Miranda Peters story but was found to have had a freezing death. That case to me was, I don't know if it's because we worked on the Saskatoon freezing deaths episode, but it seemed like there were so many similarities. It just seemed to me like the kid had only had slightly above the amount of alcohol to drive in his system. It's not like it was, you know, 2 or 3 times the legal limit. So it's like the toxicology report says he wasn't so drunk that he wandered into the woods and fell asleep, never to wake up.
Yeah. because we did do the freezing deaths episode in Saskatchewan, that stood out to me too. And of course, we're not saying that like the RCMP dropped off.
Oh, no, no, no.
But like the whole story is not there. Just a slightly above the legal limit. Some people are not even intoxicated in that situation, or they don't.
Exactly.
They wouldn't be acting intoxicated. So, and the location of the body being sort of like, almost like it was an attempt to hide it, or in kind of an area that you wouldn't think there'd be any reason for a person to be walking. Yeah, I found that very suspicious as well. And you know, maybe it's a matter of not getting a ride when he thought he was going to get a ride, or a friend going to pick him up and not, like, we'll never know, but it would have been nice to hear more about what actually happened to him rather than what seems to have been like, oh, well, here's just like another drunk Indigenous person that died.
Fell asleep under a tree and died. I know.
There's just this epidemic of us falling asleep under trees and dying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was kind of the same as what I heard on the Thunder Bay podcast, you know, people going down to the river and dying. It's, I don't know. It's like people don't just do that.
Exactly.
I know that you had some comments to make about the difficulties of getting justice, and in a case like this where we're talking about several different factors that have come together and have overcomplicated the case. What do you think about kind of the families of victims saying this isn't justice in these types of situations?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when we look at James Ward, we like his story was also sad. Like his killing of Miranda was horrifying, and listening to that reminded me of like how serious certain things are in domestic incidents, and one of them is choking, and just how serious that is, and how if you know of somebody in that kind of relationship, you need to recognize that as a significant red flag that you know, this person's in danger. Choking is usually a precursor to worse violence.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, there's this history that James had of being violent. And at the same time, he was completely failed by a system as well. I mean, the judge's comments, there was no intervention into his drinking. To be a severe alcoholic at 15, you know, you're being failed by your parents, you're being failed by a school system, a medical system. Like, it just, everything really was not there for this child who, you know, was himself also very young and obviously had very poor reasoning skills or coping mechanisms to deal with anything. So this is where I think about what it means to be a storyteller. And I think that means holding space for two truths here. Of course, Miranda's family has every right to be angry, and victim rights advocates have every right to say that they need more accountability when it comes to domestic violence crimes and murdered and missing Indigenous women. And yet there's still restorative justice. There's still people who advocated for James's rights, as well as the rights of all Indigenous people who find themselves on the other side of the carceral system. And, you know, within Cree, an elder that I speak with, Nokum Joanne, talks about how within Cree culture, when one group is talking, you come around to their side, and you have to say, like, when you're talking, you're absolutely right in what you're saying, and when I'm talking, I'm absolutely right in what I'm saying. Yeah, and that's really true in this case. Like, both sides are right, and that makes justice a complicated conversation.
Yeah, it does.
And when we tell these stories, you know, that's what I guess, just to reiterate, it is our responsibility to hold space for these truths, and listeners will have their perspectives as well. And there's just no way around that. There's not one right answer to tragedies like this.
Yeah. It was definitely a tragedy, that's for sure.
Danielle, thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to ask you what's going on around where you are in Edmonton?
Yeah, so like everywhere else, we're, well, I mean, we've always been in a pandemic, but I guess we choose to believe sometimes we are less in the pandemic. but we have a lot of online and in-person events still going on here. And one of them is LitFest, which is actually Canada's only nonfiction literary festival. So we're having Canadian authors, I think a lot of local authors, but also authors flying in to speak about their books. One of the books out is by a friend, Omar Mualim, and it's called Praying to the West, about Islam's influence in Western cultures, which is a really fascinating read. So lots of interesting authors being featured there if you're stuck at home and looking for something to zoom into.
I will leave some links in the show notes to this and some other things that Dani has been talking about, some of her other articles that she's written. And Dani, where can people find you? I know I follow you on Twitter at Dani Paradis, P-A-R-A-D-I-S. And where else?
Where else? I mean, I think on Twitter is probably the best place, but you can also find me at danielleparadis.com if you're wanting to look at my website. That just says, I'm redeveloping it right now, but it's got links to some of my work as well and some other things that I'm doing.
I've been perusing it.
I need to update that. I forget that people look at your website sometimes, you know, you're like, oh yeah. Gotta keep this fresh.
Oh, I feel you. Like, if it wasn't for every one of my episodes being posted there, I would probably forget to update it altogether. Well, thanks again, Dani, for joining us. Hopefully you'll come back one day to discuss a case with me. We have one in the works, which is going to take a bit more time, but there will be others, I'm sure. So will you come back one day and chat with us some more?
I will come back and chat with you. I've had fun today.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thanks again to Danielle Paradis for giving us her time during an extremely busy and important period. Don't forget to check the show notes for links to everything we mentioned here, and I'll see you in a few weeks with the next episode.
Manchmal willst du einfach nur ans Meer. Oder durch die Straßen einer lebendigen Stadt schlendern. Oder endlich den Moment genießen. Einfach die Welt mit TUI neu erleben. Mit TUI reist du so, wie du willst. Als Familie, zu zweit oder einfach allein. Flexibel, sicher und immer mit dem guten Gefühl, dass jemand da ist, wenn es drauf ankommt. Gestalte mit TUI Urlaub ganz nach deinen Wünschen. Überall im Reisebüro, auf tui.com und in der App.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.